In 520 BC, Haggai and Zechariah are prophets in Jerusalem, and the Lord calls Haggai and has him speak to the people, but they do not want to do what the Lord has told Haggai to tell them to do. But the Lord is going to stir up their hearts, and they will begin to do that work. The Lord speaks first to Zechariah in the middle of August of 520 BC. And in that message, the Lord tells Zechariah to tell the people to return to him. Then he speaks to Haggai on August the 29th of 520 BC. And in that message, the Lord tells Haggai to tell the people to get to work rebuilding the temple. But they do not want to get to work rebuilding the temple because they believe that they'll stir up the Samaritans who are living around them. See, there's not a wall yet to keep the Samaritans out. On September the 21st of 520 BC, the Lord tells Haggai to tell them to begin the work again, and he will bless them. And so the work begins on the temple. October the 17th of 520 BC, again through Haggai, Haggai is to tell the people to remember the first temple. And as they're remembering the first temple, they're supposed to use it as an emphasis to help them keep building this temple. In November of 520 BC, the Lord has Zechariah remind the people of how the Lord's anger had burned because his house had laid in ruins for 70 years while the whole world lived in peace. Now he mentions the three great empires of the past and the present, and he tells the future of the coming Greek Empire. The same message speaks of reconstruction of Jerusalem after the second coming and Israel's state as the apple of the Lord's eye. He has Zechariah remind them that nothing escapes his eyes. For he says, the eyes of the Lord are roaming to and fro. Zechariah also tells them that he sees a crown, and the crown is put on Joshua's head, representing the branch, or Jesus, who will build the temple of the Lord in the future. Now, Zechariah also sees Satan trying to stop this dedication of Joshua, but he is not successful. Zechariah speaks the Lord's message of how the light of the world is supplied by the oil trees. It's a picture of God the Father, God the Son, and God the Spirit. Zechariah sees a scroll which represents the law that must be followed. He sees the ephah that represents the wicked woman who will build her temple in Shinar. In another vision, Zechariah sees four chariots, each representing a man sent by the Lord to reign over the earth. There's the red horse, the black horse, the white horse, and the spotted horse. The red horse was Nebuchadnezzar. The black horse was Cyrus. The white horse is a ruler that is still to come, the ruler of the Greek Empire, Alexander the Great. And the spotted will be one of his generals, Ptolemy. On December the 7th of 518 BC, Zechariah presents a message from the Lord that tells the people to live differently. He tells them to stop wasting time fasting and to start dispensing true justice and mercy and compassion. The Lord wants his temple built. His zeal for Zion will bring his wrath if the temple remains incomplete. He encourages the builders to continue without fear, and he will provide and bless, but he wants the fast days changed into days of feasting. He foretells the doom of Syria, the Gaza Strip, and Egypt by a ruler that is to come. But he also says that Jerusalem will not be touched by that ruler. He foretells of a Greek ruler who will invade Jerusalem in the Promised Land, but the Jews will rebel and overthrow him. He foretells that the Lord will provide for their needs if they stay away from idols and false prophets. He will punish the ruler who comes, and he will make Judah a majestic horse. The true cornerstone will be born from the line of Judah, but the battle with that cornerstone will occur in Ephraim's territory. He sees Lebanon and Basham destroyed. The false shepherds of the temple in Jerusalem will wail because they thought the forest was imperishable and impenetrable, so the flock of Israel is doomed. The flawed Jewish system falls into the hands of a king that is to come. Why? The Lord will break his two staffs, favor and union, his special relationship and his covenant with Israel when they annihilate the three shepherds in 1 month, the final true prophet, the final priest, and the final king. He sees the worthless false shepherd coming, and under his authority 2/3 of Israel will die before the final third accepts the Lord and enters into a 1,000-year kingdom. But until that day, Jerusalem will be a cup of reeling, a city fought for by every nation, and each of them will pay a heavy penalty for their efforts against Jerusalem. Zechariah explains the day of the Lord. Judah will fight to defend what they can. The Lord will arrive to defend the city and destroy her enemies. Jews will mourn the loss of life that day, but the Lord will offer a fountain of salvation for Israel like she has never accepted before. No more idols, prophets, no more unclean spirits exist. He describes the battle that will be known as Armageddon and gives a short preview of life in the 1,000-year kingdom. The Samaritans are upset because they have begun to rebuild the temple again. So the Samaritans write another letter, and this time it goes to the hands of Darius. The king searches the treasury and he finds Cyrus's order, and he writes back ordering that the temple be completed and that the Samaritans are to give them everything they need to complete the temple. Darius also finds more of the temple utensils in the Persian treasury, and he sends them back to Jerusalem. On the third day of the last month of 516 BC, the temple is finally completed and a dedication service is conducted with 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and 12 male goats being sacrificed according to the Mosaic law. It is the sixth year of Darius I's reign as king of Persia. Now Passover is held on the 14th day of the first month of 515 BC. And the Feast of Unleavened Bread follows. All of Israel is blessed by the Lord, as well as all the Persians too. After Darius dies, his son Xerxes I takes over the kingdom. And in the third year of Xerxes' reign over the Medo-Persian Empire, he gives a royal banquet. And by this time, 7 more provinces have been added to the empire, and its strength is from India to Ethiopia. Now in Susa, the king displays all his riches for 180 days. And at the end of the 6 months, he gives this banquet, which lasts 7 days. The king's court of the garden in the palace is decorated beautifully. And during the banquet, Queen Vashti gives a banquet for all the harem of the king. And on the last day, the 7th day, the king calls for Vashti to come and to show off her beauty, but she refuses to come. And all the officials stir up the heart of the king because the queen has disobeyed him, and it cannot go unpunished, or the whim of the empire will follow her example. And again the king calls for Vashti, but she does not come. The officials quickly suggest that the king give the queen's position to another woman so that the wives of all these men will continue to honor them as husbands. And the king issues the decree, and it is sent throughout the empire and in every single language. After a while, the king's attendants suggest that he select another queen from the virgins of Susa. The virgins are to be put in the harem of Hegai, the eunuch, and he is to be in charge of them as well as their cosmetic needs. Now Mordecai is living in Susa, and he is the great-great-grandson of Kish the Benjamite, who had been removed from Jerusalem in 597 BC when Jeconiah, the 8-year-old king, was taken by Nebuchadnezzar and Zedekiah was put on the throne. Mordecai chose to remain in Susa when the decree was given by Cyrus allowing the Jews to return to Jerusalem. He is raising his cousin, Hadashah, also known as Esther, who is an orphan but very beautiful. And when the decree is issued to gather all the virgins, Esther is taken to the king's harem. She immediately finds favor in the eyes of the eunuch, and he gives her the best of the best, which includes 7 maids to care for all her needs. Now Mordecai warns her not to reveal that she is a Jewess, so she does not. Each and every virgin goes through a beauty treatment for 12 months, which includes oil, myrrh, spices, and cosmetics. Each in turn will have one opportunity to go into the king in his chamber in the evening, and in the morning when they come out, they will go to a new harem under the control of another eunuch. and he is the eunuch who is in charge of the concubines. They will never go back to the king's harem that is for the virgins. Once they're in the harem of the concubines, they will only go back to see the king if he calls for them. When Esther's turn arrives, she asks for nothing special to take with her to see the king. She doesn't really care about impressing the king. She joins the king in his palace on the 10th month of the king's 7th year of rule. The king loves her, and he puts a crown on her head, and he makes her his queen, and he gives a great banquet for her and proclaims a holiday. Now one day Mordecai overhears two officers of the king plotting to kill him. Mordecai tells Esther. Esther tells the king, and she tells the king that she has learned about the plot from Mordecai. The king investigates the news and finds out it to be true, and he hangs both of the men, his officials, on the gallows. The episode is then recorded in the book of the Chronicles of the king. Now the king gives Haman authority over all the princesses and over all the king's servants, and they are to bow to Haman at the gate. But Mordecai does not bow. Haman is furious with Mordecai, and he wants to kill him, and he wants to kill all the Jews. And from the first month of the 12th year of the king's rule until the 12th month of the king's 12th year, Haman casts lots every day to see if it's the proper time to present his plan to the king to kill all the Jews in the empire. The casting of the lots is called pur in the Persian language. Well, in that 12th month, Haman convinces the king that the Jewish beliefs are in conflict with the king's laws, and he issues a decree to kill all the Jews. And when the Jews are dead, Haman will put 10,000 talents of silver in the king's treasury. Well, the king says to Haman, "The silver is yours, keep it, and so are the people. So go do as you will." On the 13th day of the first month of the king's 13th year, the decree is signed by the king and sent to all of the 127 provinces in the empire. When Mordecai hears the decree, he is crushed and he is mortified, as are all the rest of the Jews in the empire when the decree reaches them. Mordecai puts on sackcloth and he mourns. When Esther hears about the decree, she mourns deeply too. Esther calls for Hathach, her personal eunuch, and asks him to go to Mordecai to ask what has caused this decree. Mordecai sends back all the details to Esther through Hathach. Esther sends back word that she is helpless because she cannot go to the king without being summoned unless he extends the golden scepter to her. She hasn't been with him in over 30 days. Mordecai replies through Hathach that if she does not do something, the Lord will defend the Jews and she will not escape. Perhaps she has obtained the royalty for such a time as this. Esther's reply asks Mordecai to assemble the Jews in Susa together and to fast for her for 3 days, and she will have her maidens do the same. On the third day, she says, "I will go to the king." So on the third day, Esther goes to the door of the king, and sure enough, he invites her to come in. He sees her distress, and he offers her whatever she asks. So she asks if Haman and the king will join her for a banquet. Haman is summoned, and they both attend. At the banquet, the king asks again what he can do for Esther, and she asks if Haman and the king will join her again on the next day for a banquet, and both agree. Now, on the way home, Haman sees Mordecai, and when Mordecai does not bow, it is all Haman can do to control himself. At home, Haman's friends and his wife Zeresh convince him to build a gallows 75 feet high and to go and ask the king if he can hang Mordecai. Haman thinks it's a great idea, so he has the gallows built that day. Haman is so proud that he is of such a stature that he is the only person invited by the queen to come to a banquet with the king. That night, the king is sleepless, so he calls for the chronicles to be brought to him so he can read the histories. He reads about the good deed of Mordecai, and he realizes that he has not rewarded him with a gift. The next morning, the king asks if anyone is in the court, and Haman is there because he's come to ask if he can hang Mordecai. The king tells Haman that he wants to reward a man with a royal robe and a horse that has been ridden by him. "Who is this man?" Haman asks. And he is mortified when he learns that it is Mordecai. Well, Haman does as the king asks, leading Mordecai through the streets on the king's horse with the king's robe. Later that day at the banquet, Haman hears the king ask Esther if he can do something for her, and she explains the plight of her people because of the decree instigated by Haman. Her people have been sold, but not as slaves, and Haman is the wicked foe. The king is angry and he goes out into the court. Haman falls on Esther's couch, begging her for his life. And when the king comes back in, he thinks Haman is assaulting the queen. The king's attendants grab Haman and they cover his mouth. Harbonoah, one of the palace eunuchs, suggests that Haman be hung on the gallows that he built at his own home. And the king says, "Hang him on it." That day, Esther falls at the feet of the king, asking what can be done about the decree, but the decree cannot be stopped by Medo-Persian law. The king tells Esther to write a decree to her people and to seal it with his ring. On the 23rd day of the third month of the king's 13th year, a decree is sent to all 127 provinces for the Jews to take up arms and to defend themselves on the day they are to be slaughtered. This new decree, which conflicted the first decree, struck such fear in the people that many joined the Jewish faith. 7 months later, on that eventful day, 500 are killed in Susa, and the king can only imagine what the death toll is throughout his kingdom. Once again, the king asks Esther what he can do for her, and she requests that the 10 sons of Haman be hung on the gallows. The king decrees it so. 75,000 are killed throughout the empire by the Jews. Mordecai is then promoted to the second in the kingdom, and he sends a letter proclaiming a holiday called Purim, because Haman had cast Pur, or lots, to determine when he would bring fruition to his plan to kill the Jews. It is to be a day of feasting and rejoicing and giving of food to one another, especially the poor. Queen Esther then sends a letter confirming Mordecai's letter with instructions for the day, and the songs of their lamentations, and for the rest of his life, the king shows great favor to the Jewish people in his kingdom. After Xerxes dies, his son Artaxerxes I allows Ezra to return to Jerusalem with every Jew who wished to join him in 458 BC. Ezra is a direct descendant of Aaron, Moses' brother. Artaxerxes writes a letter to Ezra instructing all the Persian government in Israel to give him everything that he needs to do his work. In the city of Babylon, an offering of gold, silver, priestly garments, and other things are given to Ezra to take. The people then assemble for 3 days at the river, and Ezra discovers there are no Levites among the crowd. Word is sent back, and Levites are enlisted to join the group. Ezra seems to be embarrassed to ask Artaxerxes for an armed escort to ensure a safe journey with all the wealth he is taking back. They pray, and the Lord hears their plea. It takes 5 months to make the journey, and on the fourth day, all the wealth is collected and recorded. All the people gather, and they offer 12 bulls, 96 rams, 77 lambs, and 12 male goats before the Lord. After everything is secure in the temple treasury, the leading men of Israel approach Ezra to tell him about the sins of the men. Many have married Canaanite women. Ezra is broken-hearted, and he mourns the sins of the people. The men approach Ezra with a plan to put their wives away. Ezra agrees. A call goes out for all the Israelites to assemble within 3 days. Anyone who does not assemble is to be excluded from Israel. All the men assemble in the rain, and the plan is presented. Only a few men refuse. It takes 2 months to investigate all the marriages and the wives who worship foreign gods. A list is compiled of all the offenders, which include priests, Levites, singers, and the sons of Israel. Some of them had wives by whom children were born. The wives are to be put outside the cities in a camp of their own. They are not to be brought back and to be treated as wives unless they turn their faith back to the Lord. However, the men are to provide for all of their needs for the rest of their lives when they are living in the other camps. 13 years later, after Ezra moved to Jerusalem, In 452 BC, Nehemiah finds out that the wall of the city is still in shambles. It breaks his heart. He is the cupbearer of King Artaxerxes, and when he goes in to perform his duty for the king, Artaxerxes asks him about his downtrodden face. Nehemiah explains his concern, and Artaxerxes assigns him to go to Jerusalem and to make the repairs. Once in Jerusalem, Nehemiah surveys the damage of the wall at night for 3 nights. He makes a plan and he assembles all the men of Israel, assigning them different portions of the wall to rebuild all around the city. When the work begins, Sanballat, a Samaritan, ridicules the work and he asks Nehemiah to come speak with him 5 times. But Nehemiah refuses, and finally, Nehemiah sends a message that he is doing a great work and cannot stop. Sanballat accuses Nehemiah of building the wall so he can be king. Nehemiah will be the governor of Israel, appointed by Artaxerxes, but at this time, he is just leading the efforts to rebuild the wall. Nehemiah stops all the excessive interest being charged on loans, and he pays for all of his own meals out of his own pocket. Neither the government nor the temple pays for his expenses. After 52 days, the wall is complete, and all the nations lost their confidence in their own abilities because they knew the task had been completed by God's help. When the wall is finished, guards are assigned for the walls and the gates of the city because it's very large and very spacious. A census is taken of all the men who returned from the Babylonian exile. There were 42,360 men besides their male and female servants, which totaled 7,337 people. There were 245 male and female singers, along with 736 horses, 245 camels, 6,720 donkeys, 1,000 drachmas, 50 basins, 530 priest garments. Other leading men gave to the temple 20,000 gold drachmas and 2,200 silver minas. The people added 20,000 gold drachmas and 2,000 silver minas and 67 priest garments. And on the first day of the 7th month, all the people gathered in the square to listen to Ezra read the law of Moses. He reads from early in the morning until noon. A wooden podium is built for him to stand on, and he is assisted by men on his right and his left. As Ezra reads, some of the people do not understand Hebrew because they speak the Chaldean, Babylonian, Persian languages. The old men who know all the languages translate them as Ezra is reading. They learn of the Feast of Booths, which is to be celebrated in the 7th month, so it is begun again that month. All the people confess their sins, and a real revival permeates the nation of Israel. They make a covenant together to serve the Lord. They write it in a document. It is signed by Nehemiah, the priest, and many others. Everyone wanted to live in Jerusalem, but the city cannot hold them all. They decide to cast lots for the privilege. 1 out of every 10 can live in the city, and the others will have to live in cities throughout Israel. Overseers are selected, and they all will travel to their new homes. However, the wall must be dedicated first. Before they can dedicate the wall, Zerubbabel arrives from Babylon with a whole host of priests and Levites. They are just in time to join the dedication of the wall before the people return to their homes. 2 choirs are assembled, and the priests are stationed with trumpets around the wall. Contributions are collected, and the people rejoice. Ezra reads the law of Moses on the dedication day, and they realize they must rid the temple and Jerusalem of the Moabites and the Amorites, so God will turn the curse into a blessing. They remove Tobiah, who is related to a priest by marriage, and they cleanse the temple. The tithe is restored, as well as the Sabbath, and all the marriage to the people who worship foreign gods is forbidden. Nehemiah sees to it that every vow and promise to the Lord is kept during his rule. Just 48 years later, in 404 BC, the people of Israel have forgotten their love for the Lord and the Lord's love for them, and they've turned back to their evil ways. They are corrupt. The Lord sends one last prophet. Malachi presents the Lord's last audible conversation with Israel before the Lord is silent for 400 years, until he sends an angel to announce the birth of John the Baptist, the Elijah to come. He mentions the theme of Obadiah, which is Edom's reestablishment, only to be destroyed one day. The Lord pleased with the leadership in the temple to return to Him and to serve Him correctly. But their corruption abounds. Will just one priest shut the gate and not accept a blemished, crippled offering? He begs them to trust Him and to see Him pour out His blessing. Stop robbing God, he says, but Israel's arrogance stands in the way. The next word from the Lord will be to announce the messenger preparing the way of the Lord. And although it may seem that the Lord is silent during those years, the Lord is still working in the lives of His people, as will be seen in the many fulfilled prophecies over the next 400 years.